Okay. Good morning. Yes. So we are almost done. But still winter, no spring, but let's do the oral exam and then the spring will approach very quickly. Having said that, I hope you have received an announcement from my side regarding the oral exam. Date, time slot, and room or the place. Very important to ensure that you have received the mail, read the mail, understood the mail. I ask to reply, to confirm. So far, I have not even received half of the feedback. I don't know whether you haven't received it or what the reason is why you have not confirmed. So I encourage you to read the mail and just press reply and confirm. That's it. Then I know that we are in communication. Otherwise, there's no point for us to wait in the exam room if you do not show up or if you're not interested or I don't know. So that is the first announcement. Then I hope you have also noticed the feedback related to assignment or coursework number two. So please spend a couple of minutes to read through the comments and the feedback, which also could be beneficial for the oral exam. So then the plan for today is a kind of sum up of what we went through in the course and through the content. So I will start with the first hour, then Ivan will come at 11 o'clock. So that's the plan. So basically, we are wrapping up the different topics that we have addressed since January. Any questions otherwise so far? Yes. Maybe I can mention again that please have a look at the blackboard and the tab about the lectures. So there you will get a very clear indication. So what was the aim of the different lectures? You will find the course, also the lecture notes, and you will find an indication which chapter has been addressed related to the textbook. And then you also see what is relevant and what is not relevant, or what has not been covered. So that's kind of the first step. Okay, then let's have a look. Okay. Okay. So we started to introduce the course, which is divided into two modules. This is not working. Let's give it a try with this. So the two modules are related to introduction to human color vision and perception. And then the module two, which was based on Mustad, was color and meaning, color-related aspects of universal design. And then both module had a coursework to conduct. And now, just after Easter, we will do the oral exam. So the structure of the first module was we had a lecture, an introduction to human color vision. We addressed the importance of the light quality. If we talk about color, then the light is a very important parameter or element to consider. Adjacent to the color vision, the detection of certain surfaces and color and surrounding. We learned about different visual phenomena. And also very important for universal design is to take care of the population who suffers a certain type of color vision or has a reduced color vision, typically in the red-green area. And then we also talked about typical device colors and non-device colors. Also device colors, RGB, CMYK, different type of user interface, as in terms of mixing colors. I assume you learned how difficult it is to mixture red, green, and blue, or to get an understanding what the numbers means in terms of mixing 125, 255, and zero. Versus to use a different type of user interface where you cope with the three attributes, lightness, saturation, and color U, which is much more intuitive to mixture a certain type of color. So these were the five chapters, and the aim of this first hour is a kind of to recap now all these five lectures. Yeah, Khalid? How was that? I don't remember what we asked last year. I need to check the questions, or I need to talk to Ivan. I think Ivan had a very simple question in terms of hexa codes. That's right. But let's ask Ivan. Yeah. Ah, yeah, it was something like that. Yes, now I'm able to recall. Yes, so that's what we called a kind of a case. Yeah. But it is expected or it is assumed that you went through that in the lecture, and I mean for you guys this is very fundamental. I mean, isn't it? No. You do not agree, Colin?
No, I think I missed the lecture.
Okay. Good. But that's your responsibility then. Any other questions? Okay, just interrupt then. So we started with human color vision. We talked about why do we see colors. We talked about the different components through our eye, starting from the lens, the aperture, and then very important the photoreceptors on the retina. And also we addressed the two most common theories which explains the human color vision. So that was a kind of the content of the first lecture. And then a very important question which you might expect in 2 weeks is, yeah, what is color? So we talked about a light source is needed, perhaps an object which has certain properties in terms of transmitting or translucing or absorbing or reflecting certain wavelengths. And then there is a sensor needed to detect the photons. So we concluded that color is a sensation formed by a combination of these three elements, and very important, there is no color in the electromagnetic spectrum, only waves. And then we discussed two ways 250 years ago, two very famous who explained the way we perceive color. And the one who is kind of related to the physics, also colors related to the light beams, that was Isaac Newton. So he stated that color is the product of light at certain wavelengths. And he conducted this kind of very famous prism attempt where where the prism then is dividing the white light into the different wavelengths and obtaining the rainbow colors. But then a little bit later, among some scientists, Wolfgang Goethe was clearly not, or did clearly not agree with Newton, and he said that the color is basically the product of the observer's mind. And nowadays, we know that both definitions need to be taken into account. So we concluded that color vision is based on physical elements such as light, surface properties, spectral properties, the physiology, also the study of the function of the organism of the eye, and the sensitivity of the photoreceptors. And then this leads to the perception or sensation based on the brain's interpretation of the signals. then we talked about the retina, which is considered as a part of the central nervous system, and it is the part of the eye that captures the visual impression. So basically, the eye is an extension of the brain. And we also learned about the pathway that the light is entering and the photons are traveling through a number of cell layers before they reach finally the two main photoreceptors, the cones and the rods. And then the cones and the rods are connected through the horizontal cells, through the bipolar cells, meaning that there are several inputs leading to one certain signal in the brain. And the basic principle why it is built like that, it is all about contrast. So as we talked about a couple of times, contrast is needed to be able to distinguish between shades and objects, and that we are able to navigate. And that is actually happened partially through these different cell layers. Then we talked about the cones and the rods. We concluded that the rods are sensitive in lower levels. We learned about the term scotopic vision for dark vision compared to photopic vision, also, or day vision, based on the cones responsible for color vision. Also, we learned about the three type of cones, sensitive for the short wavelength area of the visible spectrum, or the blue, then the medium, the M cones for the green area, and the L cones for the red cones. And also we learned about the distribution, or the number of cones, which is not equally distributed. So we have the least S cones, and then M cones and L cones, which we have the most. So we talked about the three type of cone rod functions. Photopic, mesopic, where both the cones and the rods are active, and probably in this environment, I assume it is a typically photopic vision in environment. Then we also learned about the most central point for color vision, which is the fovea, which is a small pit in the retina at the back of the eye, and has approximately 1.5 millimeter diameter. It's also called the yellow spot. So this area just contains cones. Just contains cones, yes, but no rods. Then we talked about the sensitivity of these two type of photoreceptors. So we learned that the cone spectral sensitivity function is also represented by what is called photopic vision, or V lambda. And we see that the accumulated sensitivity of these three cones are at approximately 550 nanometers. But when it comes to night vision, where the rods are active only, then there is a shift from 550 nanometer towards the bluish area to 500 nanometers, which is called the scotopic V prime lambda. We also learned about what is called the unnormalized cone fundamentals. So if I go back to this graph, so then this is typically called relative sensitivities. So all the peaks are normalized to the same top, also to either to 1.0 or 100%. This is one way of visualizing the sensitivity, but it does not tell the real the entire story in terms of the distribution and the sensitivity. So another way of representing that is what is called an unnormalized cone fundamentals or relative distribution. And then we can recognize that the blue sensitivity is much, much lower compared to the green and to the red. And that is what we also know if somebody is using this type of design. Or the opposite, you know, it is also known white background and yellow text. It's very difficult to distinguish then from the text and to the background, or black background and blue. So there is almost no contrast, and this is due to the fact of these very low sensitivity, and also the number of S cones. We talked about phenomena related to V prime lambda and V lambda, so photopic vision and scotopic vision, also the shift from kind of reddish sensitivity to the bluish sensitivity, meaning that if in daytime, if we look at the red and blue tulipans, then we might consider the red tulipans in daytime much brighter compared to the blue ones. But then if there is almost no light, then the red tulipans there will be pitch black, and the blue tulipans will appear kind of slightly grayish. And that is what is called the Purkinje shift. Then we addressed the two most dominant theories explaining how color vision is functioning. The first one is related to Young-Helmholtz three receptor theory, where they concluded that in our retina we have three cones, red, green, and blue, responsible for all or any kind of colors we can perceive. 50 years later, it was Hering who looked more at the qualitative aspect of colors and said there were six primary colors in three pairs. So he talks about the red green, the red green, and the yellow, the blue, and the third pair is the lightness, also from white to black. And also nowadays, we know that the human process is indeed three types of photoreceptors combined by the Young-Helmholtz and also we know that there is an opponency happening in the perception, and we have proved that then with one of the typical phenomena with the after image effect. So to conclude the first lecture, we asked the question, where are the colors when it is dark? It's a kind of a more philosophical question, but we talked about whether the objects, also whether the color is part of the object, or is the color independent of the object? Or we talked about, does the color disappear at night, or if there is no light in the room, or what is happening with the color? And we learned that the color is an interpretation of certain signals in the brain. So the color is not related to certain objects. That is just a physical component. Any questions to the first part? Light source, light quality, we talked about the basic parameters in lighting, spectral power distribution, color temperature, a measure metric for measuring the color or the light quality, color rendering index, and very important. We also talked about metamerism. So we talked about the difference between luminous flux. We talked about luminous intensity measured in candela. We talked about illuminance, as the measurement in lux of how much light is falling on that surface. And the light entering the eye, there we talk about luminance or brightness. So if you look typically at your display on the laptop, then we talk about luminance or brightness measured in candela per square meters. And probably typical if you would measure your displays, then we talk about 120, 140, 160 candela per square meters unit for a display. And if we talk about high dynamic range imaging, then we talk about 1,000 or 1,500 candela per square meters, which is then much, much more bright. Then in terms of the light quality or the energy distribution, we learned about the term spectral power distribution curve, meaning that it indicates how much energy. So if that is the energy axis, this is the visible spectrum, and we see how much energy we have in the blue area, how much energy we have in the green, yellow area, and towards infrared or red infrared. And then, so this is a typical continuous spectrum of a tungsten light source. Then with this spectral power distribution, we can define other type or any type of light source. So this is a typical SPD of a light from an idealized northern sky. And that is a typically fingerprint of a fluorescent tube, which indicates what kind of gas the tube is containing. Nowadays, it is basically the lead-emitting diodes, which has become the standard light source. And we also learned that normally to produce white light, we talk about three primary colors, red, green, and blue. Red, green, and blue. And then we notice that in an additive mixture environment, red and green result in yellow. So then we could replace a red lead and a green lead with a yellow lead. So this is much more efficient, much more cheaper, using then two leads, a blue lead and a yellow lead to produce white light. And then we have typically these type of spectral power distribution. Then we did an experiment, or we demonstrated the experiment that Newton did with a tungsten light, where we got a very smooth, continuous rainbow. We also used that rainbow to check the camera's quality. So is the camera able to distinguish between all the small visible shades, or do we get some banding effect in the camera because the camera sensitivity is not as good as our perception? Talked about a very poor color rendering index. Typically, this street lighting, low pressure sodium. So, if we measure it, we measure just some energy in the yellow area. And then we discussed whether this type of light source is a kind of an appropriate light source to use for photographical activities. So we will result in a color check just these type of brownish colors. Then another metric to describe the color properties of a light source is the concept of color temperature. And we learned that color temperature is measured not in Celsius, but in Kelvin scale. And zero Kelvin is equivalent to minus 273 Celsius. And the concept is based on the black body radiator. So if we heaten up this metal pot, then the color turns into a kind of reddish, and we talk about 900 Kelvin. If we heat it up even more, 1700 Kelvin, then it becomes a kind of yellowish, then it becomes whitish, and then above 5,000 Kelvin, it is considered as a bluish. And that is also the color which we relate very often to a white point. So if we calibrate a monitor, then we can do the calibration according to a certain Kelvin. So if you want to have a kind of a bluish type of white point, then we can calibrate the monitor up to 7,000-8,000 Kelvin. Or vice versa, if you want to have a kind of a warmish white, then we calibrate the monitor according to 3,500 or 4,000 Kelvin. Then we talked about color rendering intents index, which is a measure of the ability of a light source to reproduce the color of various objects. And we learned that it is very important for certain applications to have these appropriate light sources, typically food industry or textile industry, where we are dependent to have light sources which is able to exhibit almost the same energy across the visible range, and so then is able to reflect the light of the object. To avoid to get these kind of dull fruits or food in general. Then we talked about metamerism. So the term metamerism is defined from Greek and refers to equality under certain circumstances. And if we talk about certain circumstances and we look at this image, then we see there are two objects. The one object might be, let's say, photopaper, and the other object is newspaper. So the physical properties of these two objects, photopaper and newspaper, are not identical. But using this light source, the color looks identical for the observer. And then changing the light source, then the color match fails, or there is a mismatch between the newspaper and the photopaper. And that is basically due to the number of photoreceptors, or the number of cones we have in the retina. So if we look at this schematic explanation, if you have a real object, and that real object is illuminated by a light source, with a very narrow band yellow light source. And these are our cone sensitivity function, S, M, and L. So if we multiply schematically the light source with this, we end up with these signals. And then on the monitor, calibrated according to a certain calibration parameters, we get this white light, or this yellow light, multiplying with the cone sensitivity function. And in that case, we end up with the same sensitivity. Also, the amount of SML information is exactly the same with this illuminant and with this illuminant. So we get a match. But if we would change the illumination either there, or we would change the calibration on the monitor, then the total amount is not equal anymore, and then there is a mismatch. So if we would have had 5, 6, 10, 20 different cones, then the likelihood is much, much higher to get the same match. But due to the fact we have only 3 cones, then the likelihood is quite high to get kind of identical outcomes. Or this example is perhaps more a better example. So if we have a jacket, a cotton jacket, and we are looking for a black trousers as well, but not in cotton, but nylon or another fabric, then under a certain illuminant, in that case, there will be a visible match. But then typically, or it could be an outdoor scene, then we might observe that these two textiles are not matching. But then also we learn, I mean, this could be a kind of the challenge or the negative side when we talk about metamerism. But the beauty and the positive with metamerism is that we are able to reproduce real color with red, green, and blue, or with cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. So without metamerism, it would not be possible to reproduce this chlorophyll, this green organic material on paper. But now we know we can mix a little bit of cyan and a little bit of yellow, and we obtain green. And that is basically what metamerism is about. Any questions to that? Okay, let's move on. Color phenomena. We talked about colored shadows. I won't go into the details. We talked about color constancies. Basically talk about that a yellow banana appears yellow whether we have a white illumination or we have a greenish illumination or a colored illumination as such. Because we are able to discount for the color in the lighting. So therefore, the color remains constant. Of course, if we use an extreme, then this kind of theory might fail. But we know that slightly changes in the illumination, the color remains constant. So we are adapting to that environment. And that is what color constancy is about. We also talked about an optical phenomenon which causes the perception of stimuli to be strongly influenced by the adjacent or background colors in the visual field. That can be brightness contrast. It can be a color contrast. Also chromatic contrast or a combination. And that is what the simultaneous contrast is about. So these two stimuli, they look rather equal. And if we would measure these two, we would measure or we would obtain exactly the same number. But having different background colors, then I assume this one appears slightly darker and this color now appears slightly lighter. But physically, they remain exactly the same. And so that type or that phenomenon has been used by many artists. Among one of them is Josef Albers with these two X's, which are identical, but then having on a different background, this one appears rather darker than this. Simultaneous contrast. Then we learned about Ewald Hering's theory, which is true. So we talk about after image effect. So after, because if we steer for half a minute on that black point and we focus on the red patch, then the retina gets exposed to this stimuli. So in other words, the red photoreceptors, the cones, they are activated constantly on that stimuli, whereas the green and the blue, they are not triggered as much as the red. But if we change now the scene, then blue and green are firing immediately, whereas the red still the red cones, it takes a couple of seconds to stabilize or to recalibrate, and during these couple of seconds, the appearance is the opposite or the contrast color of the stimuli, which was red. Opposite color, contrast color. What was that? Complementary color of red. Should we give it a try again? Steer on the black spot. Focus on the red color. So what do we perceive here? Cyan. Exactly. And cyan is basically the additive combination of blue and green. And that is what we perceive in the first couple of seconds by changing the scene. So this phenomenon is kind of explained there. Then we talked about color vision deficiency. We defined what color deficiency is about. We talked about the reason, and we came up that it can be acquired, meaning that through diseases and perhaps drugs. Such as Plonkinil, which is a preventive treatment for a certain type of malaria type of diseases. That can cause color blindness. But the most common cause of impaired color vision is inherited fault in the development of one or more of the three sets of color sensing cones. So we learned that color vision is part of the X chromosome. And since females have two X chromosomes, then the chance is much less to be affected by color vision deficiency, because then both X chromosomes need to have a defect. But the men, they have only one X chromosome, and that one X chromosome comes from the mother, while the Y chromosome comes always from the father to the boy, and the X chromosome from the father goes to the girl. So if the father has a defect X chromosome and the mother has one defect chromosome, and these two X goes to the girl, then the girl might have a certain color deficiency, which is very seldom. So the chance or likelihood that the boy gets a certain color deficiency is much higher. And it always comes through the mother. Then we talked about major types of CVDs. So we talk about anomalous trichromats, named protanomaly in typically red cone, Deuter anomaly in green cone, and Trito anomaly in the blue cone. So the point is that all three cones are in function, but there is a sensitivity shift, mainly between the green and the red. So if the red is moved towards the green, for instance, then we talk about the protanomaly, and if the green has a certain shift in the sensitivity direction, then we talk about Deuter anomaly. Whereas if we talk about a protanope or a deuteranope or a tritanope, then one type of cone is absent, is not functioning. So indicating that here the red cone is kind of disappeared. So then we talk about a protanope. If the green cone is not functioning, a deuteranope, and also very seldom if the blue cone is not functioning, then we talk about a tritanope. It's 11 o'clock, Ivan, but you give me 1, 2, 3 more minutes. Then we talked about the distribution of these color vision defects, and rule of thumb is it's approximately 7-8% of the Western population, which might have a certain type of color division deficiency. We are not talking about color blindness, as I said. Probably there is only one monochromate in all Jøvik. So one out of 40,000 has a monochromatic vision. But it is quite frequently that we can have a certain anomaly, also a certain shift of the sensitivity of the cone. Then we talked about color vision tests. We talked about mainly four type of tests: recognition test, arrangement test, and also we mentioned an anomaloscope and a lantern test. So Ishihara test, we learned about these type of schematic plates where we have a certain background color and then we have a certain color for the figure or for the number in that case. And we also talked about, it is a very common easy test, but be aware of that Ishihara is only for a first screening, but not very reliable for diagnosis. Then we talked about confusion lines. We learned that for protanope. So all the colors on these lines are perceived as the same from a protanope. So we learned about the chromaticity diagram where we have the medium wavelength area or the greenish and the red. So that means all colors along that line or along that line is perceived as the same for a protanope. And likewise for the protanope, where the confusion lines are slightly different, or then for the tritanope, which these confusion lines. So then coming back to that graph, so if we have the background colors with these dots in the red orange part, then we could think of these colors are taken from that area, and then on the same line, the greenish dots are then this 74 number. And again, for a protanope, it would be then difficult to distinguish between these color stimuli and the green number. And now we have seen other type of recognition tests, HRR instead of numbers. We have these geometrical figures. Then we did an arrangement test, an ordering test with these different caps. We talked about an anomaloscope, which is probably the most accurate instrument where we can do a color match. So we can choose a test color, and then there is a red primary and a green primary, and we can ask the observer to obtain a visual match against the test color under different luminance levels. And then based on that, we can analyze the result, and we might obtain a rather clear and accurate diagnosis of the observer. Lantern test, that is historical-based. We won't go into the details. Then we talked about simulation, and that is, again, very, very important for a designer. Also, a kind of to demonstrate a design how a color vision deficient observer is able to distinguish between different stimuli or between information. Where then, in that case, where we have the original colors, and all these colors, they will fall on one or on two dimension, from green from yellow to blue for deuteranope. Yeah, and we do have multiple ways of simulating, like in Photoshop. We learned about the importance, how to simulate, and we also learned about design, which is very inappropriate with these samples. Another step is not only to simulate, but to adjust the information for either the CVD or for all observers, as I talk about universal design. And that is based on John Dalton, called Daltonization, which is an algorithm to process digital image to improve, basically, contrast. So again, it's all about contrast. If you have a stimuli, a red and a green stimuli, which is not detectable by deuteranope or a protanope, then the idea is actually to reduce or increase the contrast between the red and the green, so that there is so that it is possible to detect the two stimuli. I think you will address device colors, non-device colors. I remember that this is part of your curriculum. Okay. Any questions so far? Do you need 5 minutes, or can we just continue? That was a question. No answer, then I think we continue. Sure. Ah, okay. Now we need a break. Okay. Okay. 5 minutes. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Ja, jag brukar den. Ja, men jag kan bruka den. Så jobbar. Ja, jag kan bruka den. Det är fint. Jag får det till upptag.
Tack.
Jag köper.
Men jag har inte lagt det. Det var ingen som spurte. Jag tänkte jag. Nej. Jag har det i tillfället.
Ja, jag har ju inte. Vi har ju inte. Har inte länge någon rutin på att driva tal på.
Nej. Jag gjorde det bara liksom. For min skyld.
Ja, jeg skjønner. Ja. Den på mute nå, jeg skal prøve, eller...
So, ooh, microphone, yeah. Okay, so this will be a summary of module two, and we'll be touching on the topics and themes that we have discussed in the labs and worked with. So firstly, we start by having a look again at the light as a phenomenon. And again, some of this will maybe touch upon something that Peter has been talking about. But Newton did the many experiments and refracted the white light through a prism to reveal the spectrum. And this was based on a paper published in 1672. And Newton was the first to say that he said to have understood the rainbow effect. So this is the effect where the different wavelengths refract in different angles, known as chromatic aberration. So we know that the spectrum is part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and it's only a small part of the spectrum that is what we call visible light, roughly then from 380 nanometers to 780 nanometers. And it's said that we can perceive roughly 200 different hues along this visible spectrum, but also more than a million if you also add light and intensity. Again, taking from the electromagnetic spectrum into what we can refer to as models or ways of describing color numeric, we go through the CIE XYZ diagram, in which we are also referred to as the horseshoe diagram, in where we... okay, does this work? Oh. Where is my pointer? There it is. In which the spectrum is kind of outlined around this horseshoe here. So that means this is the visible spectrum, and then we also have the magentas and purple tones, in which it kind of is a mix of the blues and the reds of the spectrum. But there is a problem with the XYZ diagram when it comes to numerically describing visual appearance differences. So we have the McAdam ellipses, which, if we have a value, say we have this point in the middle of this green ellipsis here, all these colors inside of this ellipsis can be seen as similar or the same color. So in the green part of the spectrum in the XYZ diagram, huge color differences in numerically are nearly non-indistinguishable. Whereas in the blue part of the spectrum, we can see there this small one down in the bottom here, even minuscule color differences in numerically is quite huge when it comes to visual appearance difference. That means that this diagram is not, or this color model is not very useful when it comes to seeing numbers and trying to discern how different is this color, are these colors from each other. But it's still used, for example, for defining other color spaces, for example, as sRGB, which has the primaries defined in XYZ. So, sure. And also defines the white point of these color spaces. But we have another color space, CLAB, which is more, what can I say, based on Hering's opponent theories, in which we have opposing colors, for example, green and red, which goes from minus 100 to plus 100, and a axis B, which goes from yellow to blue. And if we have zero in both these values, then we have a neutral gray color. The last axis of the CLAB color space is lightness, which goes from totally pitch black to bright white. So inside of this color space, which is kind of a cube when if we visually examine it, which can also both, of course, contain all the visible colors that we can output on screens or through devices such as printers or other output mediums. It can also contain colors that is impossible to achieve anyhow. For example, a pitch black color that is also laser red. We can say this color, but we cannot actually output it in any way. So working in CLAB as a color space for mixing colors or creating colors can be a dangerous proposition, because we can create colors in which it's not possible to actually achieve this. We also touch on devices which can work with high dynamic range, that is large color spaces, for example, newer TV screens maybe, or computer displays, and even maybe your phones can output HDR or display HDR imaging. So here we see the sRGB color space here inside of the display P3, which is the color space of the IMAX that we have in the lab. I want to activate you guys. In which context do you most seem to see sRGB as most being used? Anyone? Web. So when you're working with web colors, these are sRGB by default. We can define other color spaces for web colors, but standard, if you see a hex value or sRGB or an RGB value in a web context, it is sRGB. So, yeah, I think we're spinning this around. Okay. So, also another context when it comes to digital colors in the RGB domain, we touched upon the bit depth of colors. So, when we are talking about these digital colors which are based on the three primaries, are red, green, and blue, we can mix, for example, the red and green and achieve yellow. We can mix green and blue and achieve cyan. Or we can mix red and blue and achieve magenta. Also, with all these primaries activated or lighting up, we see white. And this is, again, through the phenomenon which I'm sure Peter has just touched upon, metamerism, which helps us mix these colors in our television system and then see all the different colors. But if you only can have the pixels, we can say, turn on or off, then we can have eight color variations here, and that's one bit per channel that we can only switch on or off each of these three pixels. If we double this and say that we have two bits per channel, that is, we have two bits we can turn off or on or off through red, green, and blue, we suddenly have 64 possible color variations. And we went through this in a big bit more depth in the original lecture. But we are then going to 8 bits per channel, and here we have 256 levels per channel. And now, with 8 bits per channel, we can achieve a continuous gradient from black to full color for all these three channels. And it gives us more than 16 million possible color variations and full color in images, for example. Again, for HDR-type displays, we generally go up to 10 bits per channel to have a decent amount of information in for example, for streaming media, keeping the data rates as low as possible, whilst also being able to have gradients which are not staggered or like staircase type things. So, for all of you who have watched Game of Thrones on your screen, on some TV screen, you have probably seen that in the dark areas, the difference between pitch black and detail is quite sudden, and that's due to that phenomenon. So we don't have enough bit depths, or it might also be, of course, be due to compression. So ways of describing these colors. We have understood that questions about hexadecimal colors have popped up today, and this has been covered in the lecture earlier on. But hexadecimal colors are built up on three parts in this system. So we have the two first numbers, which go from 00 to FF. Again, this is the 256 channels levels that we talk about when we talk about 8 bits per channel. But we are able to, instead of using three numbers, 2, 5, 6, we can compress this by having a numeric system which goes from 00 to 0F. We see that that is 15, but we also have to count the 0 in the first here. So that means we have 16 numbers per 10, if you like. So that means through this system, which goes from 00 all the way up to FF, we can describe the 256 levels for each of the colors, red, green, and blue. So the two first are red, the two second are green, and the two last are blue. So in a web context, we can define these through this example through CSS, where we can have a selector, we can say color, and then the hexadecimal value. Or we can also use more literal ways of defining these. For example, saying RGB, and then we have three values, which are the red, green, and blue. And this, again, goes from 0 to 255 then. And then we can also add an alpha channel in the end if we want to have transparency play a role. Okay. So when it comes to color spaces, in which we are not covering in depth in this lecture series, I presented this color and said that this color is created by these three RGB values. I also presented this red color, which I say is described by these three color values. And we see that the color values are different, but the color, the visual appearance color, is the same. And I also asked, how can this be? And this is due to the fact that we have the color values are defined in different color spaces, as we talk about. So we already mentioned sRGB. Adobe RGB is another one, which I will not go in depth on. But that means these three color values I present the first, they can also look like this, or look like this. And this is depending, again, on these values being defined in another color space. So the main point here is that a color value in itself, RGB values in itself, does not describe a visual appearance color if you don't also know in which color space it relates to. And generally in a web context, this is sRGB always, mostly. So that's just something to remember. When it comes to print type colors, we work with CMY and a last color. So if we had perfect primaries in CMY, we would not, in CMYK, we would only need the CMY, like RGB in the additive color system. But, and this is what the perfect primaries would look like, but the nearest we can get in pigmentation, toners, print inks, and such, is something like this, which means that if we mix these in full intensity, we get, at the best, a muddled brown color. And that makes us need a key color, which is black. And this, again, makes it possible to, in print, or to achieve a full spectrum of colors, again, creating images. But the colors are semi-opaque, and they overlap poorly. And the print colors are either covers 100% or 0%. And it's not possible to kind of halfway overlay them. So we have to achieve color mixing by using different color angles and then rastering these images, which again creates this type of rosette or halftone pattern in technical print. More useful is HSB color mode. So this is not a color model like RGB color and CMYK. This is just a way of mixing colors in RGB or CMYK. And we have three parameters. It's hue, saturation, and brightness. And this is a color mode which many of you tried to mix color and found it was very much easier to create, to kind of create a set of colors which related in some way, rather than using RGB or CMYK. One of the properties of HSB is the fact that it's easy to create variations of color. So if we, say, have a color hue 210 like this, so this is the NTNU blue here, which is color angle 210, that is the hue, the H, saturation 100, brightness 62. This defines this particular color blue. But then we can create darker variations by, for example, lowering the brightness, or we can create lighter variations by heightening the brightness, or even work in with variations of this, for example, creating bridge tones towards less saturated colors by either changing the saturation only, or again working with saturation and brightness in an example like this. So having a key color and or a primary color, and then creating a color palette with variations through HSP is quite easy and can be recommended. A final good thing about using working with HSP is the fact that it's very easy to create or find the opponent color or the complementary color. And as we know, U is described in angle in degrees, which means we work with a 360-degree color wheel, really. That means by either subtracting or adding 180 to the number, depending on if it's larger or smaller than 210, we can find the complementary color precisely. So in this example, I've created a complementary color, which instead of 210 has a color angle 30. And then I've reused the saturation and brightness values, which again gives me here four complementary variations of the color, which recreates the brightness and saturation of the original color. In a web context, we can work with HSL, not HSP. That means we can recreate define HSL instead of RGB values. And the lightness is not the same as the brightness parameter. That means we cannot mix and match HSP and just recreate the, reuse HSP value as a HSL value. They are different, so we need to mix them separately. Yeah. But still, as the HSL values, we can use directly in our CSS or in the web context. So there's a second lecture we worked with color contrasts, and we had seven of Itten's contrasts that we went through and worked a bit with. And I will go through these seven now quickly. So the first we worked with was the Itten's, the color's own contrast, that is, the fact that all colors have different spectral properties makes it such that they by the nature of their difference, trigger a color contrast response. And the largest of these contrasts are between red, yellow, and blue. And here we have a color concode with the largest possible contrast. Okay. The second color contrast we went through was the light-dark contrast. And here we have the fact, so we have some color, primary color or primary and secondary colors up in the top here. But in the bottom, we have then I've created light and dark variations of this. So we have three light colors here and two dark colors. And the contrast between the dark colors and light color makes it so that the dark colors seem to group together. The contrast between dark colors and light colors is larger than the own color on contrast in this context. Then we will touch on the warm and cold contrast. And again, parts of the color wheel can be said to have be cold, and that goes from the green colors to the blue colors, and then from the purple to the yellow colors are warm colors. And we can use these by making sure that, or by being aware that the warm colors kind of tend to pop forward or be, more approachable, whereas the cold colors kind of seem to go more into the background. So this can be used directly. A third color contrast is the complementary contrast. And all the colors have a opposing color, a complementary color. Again, working with the color wheel as we can in HSP and HSL. And some examples of this are, for example, blue and yellow, green and purple, red and cyan, and orange and another blue. Also, we talked on about the simultaneous contrast, where a color is not appear, is not cannot be judged all by itself. It is always in some context, and the context affects how we see the color. So, for example, a neutral gray color seen in a dark contrast seem lighter than the same color in a light context. And this also affects us when we see it in colored environments. For example, we did an experiment in which we had this gray color in a green square, and we had the purple squares under, and it was possible then to have difficulties to see which one is the same. In the experiment we did, you the one who volunteered managed to get it right, I think, this time, this year. So again, the context adjusts our what can I say our how we perceive color. Then we have the quality contrast, in which different saturation of the color again makes it possible for us to create contrast. And we refer to this again as quality contrast. So that is the difference between, for example, a very saturated red versus less saturated colors of the same hue. And lastly, we have the quantity contrast, in which various colors are said to have different strengths. And this can be used to create a balanced color result. So by using the color values suggested by Itten, then we can, so for example, 9 is a very strong color, which should probably not be a prominent color, but it could be used to for example, create highlights and such. And by having you can say, these color values balance oppositely, we are creating balance. So, for example, the cyan color have a color strength of 4, the orange one of 8. That means by mixing up the proportions here, we are one color is not supposed to be dominating the other one. We had examples of this where we saw it in user interface also in the lecture. Then we went into colors, different ways of building color schemes, and we have some different ways of working with this. One was the monochromatic one, in which we base ourselves on one base color and then create variations, for example, by creating lighter or darker variants. We have the analog colors, in which we, again, have a one base color and use the adjacent colors. For example, if you have orange, we can use the yellow and red colors to kind of broaden the color colors available for us in a color palette. And with example. Also, we have the complementary colors. I did mention that this should be used with with care, because it can be the complementary color contrast can be quite harsh, and if you are using this too, if you base our color palette too heavily on this, it can it must not necessarily be very nice. So, using with care. Also, we mentioned the split complementary contrast or way of mixing colors. And there, instead of using the direct complementary color, we kind of split out and use adjacent colors. So, the green can have a split complementary contrast set of purple and dark blue, for example. And then, lastly, we had a look at triadic colors, in which we, again, can use color angle difference between the colors should be the same. So 120 degrees between each color hue will then make so that we can have the largest numeric difference in the hue setting between the colors. And then, of course, we can work with the brightness and saturation also. We also worked with the value, or in Norwegian valeur, and this is dark lightness impression that each color gives. So yellow colors are, by the spectral properties, seen as quite light. If you have a dark yellow, it turns into brown. So the pure yellow is quite light, whereas a pure blue is quite dark. If you turn up the brightness of the blue, it will not again be fully saturated. It will seem as it's mixed with white. And we can use this directly, for example, to create color sets, which are by or often very, very nice to look at. For example, if we have a yellow, we can create lighter variations and dark variations. And this seems natural to us because we are already used to seeing these kind of color sets. Because, again, lighter variations of a set color and dark variations can be seen as light and shadow, which we experience all day, every day in our environment. So basing a color palette on this type of approach might be very useful. And then we can do this for several colors, for example, to have a color set which also have lighter and darker variations based on the value. We worked with color harmonies in which we try to keep some common denominator amongst the colors. For example, in this first example, here I've created a color set in which we have similar brightness and saturation values, but we change the hue. In the second one, we change the value only, so it's only dark. This is the same color hue, same saturation, but we change the darkness or lightness of it. And in the last example, I've created a color set in which we have the same color hue and color. Is it the same brightness? I must. But at least the idea is that I've changed the saturation only. So kept two properties, changed only one. We also touched upon bridge tones, in which we can create variations from two set colors. So this we can have selected ourselves, and then I went through some way of creating this, because none of the color tools that we have in our tool set directly supports this, so we have kind of to cheat to create this, and we worked with that in Adobe Experience Design, but that is, what you did there is directly relatable in, for example, Figma or Photoshop or other tools that you are using. If you did not attend that lecture, talk with somebody who did. And then we went on to the color semantics, and we went through a set of colors and talked a bit about which meaning that we can perceive in different colors. For example, when we saw the color white, this can be seen as a pure color of innocence, cleanliness, spirituality, light, faith, sterility, beginnings, sincerity, peace, softness, humility, perfection, possibility, and many more. And we talked also about socio-political connections with the colors, and we talked about in some ways that the colors are, we can say, different in, for example, Western and maybe Eastern cultures. So, for example, the color of white is in Asia, the color of sorrow, for example. So being aware of the different cultural contexts or cultural semantic meanings that color can have is quite important when we are working with defining colors, for example, for multinational brands, for example, that will be all around. And we also saw that most colors both have negative and positive contexts, and being, again, aware of these and, for example, other religious contexts, connotations by colors that we should avoid, then of course we should be aware of that. Just one more color. So yellow can be seen as color of hope, energy, sunshine, happiness, positivity, enlightenment, honor, deceit, cowardice, caution maybe. So I went through some of these colors and I split the class into groups, and you worked with finding color semantic meanings for other colors as well. So, again, being aware of the socio-political connotations or associations, for example, the fact that brown have in history been a fascist color, black, anarchistic, and so forth. There are connections there that we should be aware of. And also the fact that, again, color meanings change by both cultural and temporal variations. So a color that means something today doesn't necessarily mean the same in a month or next year. I use the example, for example, by showing the color combination of blue and yellow, which just a couple of years ago for us in Norway meant Sweden. Now we're all thinking of Ukraine. And also the symbolic and contextual associations that, again, can these colors can have. So we can never create a color that is super perfect for our abuse, but at least we should try to think of the positive positive and the context in which we are choosing the colors. And I show this information graphics by David McCandles from informationisbeautiful.net, in which he tried to gather some color meanings and from different cultures, from Western, Japanese, Hindu, Native American, Chinese, Asian, Eastern European, Muslim, African, and South American contexts. So, for example, so we have all the cultural meanings are through the layers of the circle, and then we have all the numbers around here, which have different meanings. For example, if we have a look at number 14 is cruelty. Let's have a look. It's just just in Western American culture, cruelty is purple. Again, this is not directly scientific. It is, and it changes all the time. So this information graphic is a couple of years old now. It is from April 2009. And some of these contexts or the findings would have been different today if we did the same bit of research that David McCandle did in 2009. Then on to universal design, and we know that we have to adhere to WCAG 2.1. This is regulated by law in Norway, and all websites since 2021 needs to adhere to this. So this goes for all sites that we are creating for public domain. And the and the required success criteria that Norwegian law defines being necessary when it comes to WCAG is success criteria A and AA. A triple A is it's recommended. It's not if we can do that also, but it's only by law required that we sustain the A and AA standards. And for example, this goes into contrast, which is one of the most prominent guidelines when it comes to this course and color in particular. So we had some examples from a website that I found. For example, so the requirement for text color in which text is smaller than, is it 16 pixels or 18 pixels? I can't remember still, but something like that. But the requirement for regular text is 4.5 to 1. And when I now showcase white text on black background, the actual contrast here is 21 to 1. So that is quite a large contrast. If I do the opposing, that is black color on white background, the contrast is 9.32 to 1. So that means that the perceived or the calculated the color contrast through the WCAG calculation is so that the white or the negative text, that is light text on dark backgrounds, are generally higher than opposite. So some other examples. This gray is 4.5, is 8.97 to 1. So this is still good. If I do this same color on white here, we see that this is 2.45 to 1, which is not approved. So that is out of the it's lower than the requirement and it's not good enough. And also this goes for other colors. For example, we have this white on the green, 2.53 to 1, or even the dark brown on red was 1.93 to 1. So being aware of contrast requirements and working with this is very important. And we have several tools that we have worked with. I will mention some of them in the end. I will not go into depth on color deficiency. Peter covered that. So, but again, we know about the protanopia and protanomaly, deuteranopia and deuteranomaly, and the same for tritanopia and tritanopia. Mali. Yeah. And again, this is about the color vision directly. But the context, which I mentioned it here now, is to make sure that when we are working with displaying information with color, we need to make sure that, particularly for color-critical systems or safety-critical systems, that we don't only use color. For example, one of these colors is a warning sign or a warning color that's saying, hey, something is going very wrong. And we have no way of knowing if we are, again, have a color deficiency, green, blue, color blindness, for example. We have no way of knowing which of these are cause for concern. So adding something like either some pictogram, some supporting text, something that helps us see what is a problem and what is not, is necessary. So displaying information by color only is not okay. We need to also have some way of discerning a state. And in the lecture, I also showed some more examples of this. So being, again, aware of color deficiency and information that's been displayed in various systems, creating a set of colors that in which we are supposed to be able to discern the differences, then there are some different color sets which we can discuss whether these are aesthetically pleasing ones. But at least, for example, for contexts like maps, like the London Tube map, which we touched upon in one of the lectures, where we saw that with color deficiency, it is impossible to know which route is which. But by a color palette like this, it could be possible. But still, so these are how the colors really look. And this is a simulation of what it might look for somebody with diatomnopia. Again, we can discuss whether the color difference between the yellow and the orange is large enough to discern the difference, but still there is some sort of difference here. And for all the different color vision deficiencies, this color palette is, again, one suggestion of a set of colors that can at least help everybody to at least see the difference between the colors. So when it comes to working with colors, we have a tool called Color Contrast Analyzer that we can use to find color contrast. We can also use the tool colorsafe.co to help us find accessible color combinations. So if you know of one of our base colors, we can get contrast colors, for example, for use for large or medium text. And also there is a link to UU-tilsynet, which has a... it's part of the Digitalisering Directorate, and which is kind of adhering covering the universal design of information communication technology systems. So this again is, I will be putting out this lecture after, but it's also again from the earlier lecture, and this is directly linked so that you can go and do some more research yourself. Also. using WebAIM, or the tool Wave from WebAIM, to scrutinize a published website for usability problems when it comes to WCAG, and then color contrast directly can be used. And again, some tips is when you start prototyping, don't consider color at all. Use working grayscale to achieve large enough contrast first, and then this can be a guideline for some visual designer after that are actually making sure that they're using dark enough color contrasts. A main text should generally be around 16 pixels. This is just some general tips. And then the last topic I will be covering is coloring interactions. And some general advice again there is that you should not overuse colors. Colors should be used with intention, for example, to capture attention, show actionable elements, or it might be a good idea to try to use a single key color, again, for example, for actionable elements or buttons, for example. And again, for creating color set, using nature as inspiration to create something that is aesthetically working well. We went through some different approaches, like working with mood boards for creating color samples or image samples or visual collections that kind of try to capture what you want to achieve with something. And again, in the workshop, you work with trying to create a create a mood board for example, for an energy bar chocolate, for example, to try to find something that works. So this is one way, again, of trying to find a design direction for a certain project. And this can be either broad-type mood boards in which you try to collect every inspiration source you can find, or it can be narrow ones. For example, looking just into color, or into typography, or into some other field. We also had a look at style tiles as a tool for, we can say, to examine a mood and style of a certain design. And we saw this example from the Examiner, in which we had first one edition and then a revision of the design in which color had a more prominent role. So color were both revised here. So with the red, for example, it's turned into a bit darker red. And it was quite effective, because we see that the use of the color red in the second example here, it gets more a bit darker. It becomes a bit more heavy. It's more, we can say, it seems more serious, really. Yeah. So tweaking colors to achieve what you really want is a good idea. And then we had a look also at element collages as a way of working with I wouldn't say prototyping, but sketching out design ideas, both for use of color and for micro interactions, and as seen here. So this is something that has not been coded or prototyped dynamically still. It's just a way of working with trying to showcase something that might be a good idea. And then Brad Frost's idea about interface inventory. And again, you worked with trying to do something like this with Blackboard, to try to find if the all interface elements did adhere to the same use of color, the same typographical hierarchy and such. So this was, a tool for trying to investigate whether a set or a certain web-based solution maybe is coherent, or if it might actually be a target for redesign. And then finally, using images or nature as a source for inspiration, for example, by having images in which you capture colors from the image and then use that as a basis for color set. Again, can be tweaked, but this can be a good idea as a starting point for having colors that naturally connect. And I also did an experiment, not an experiment, but an example in which I used this for example, creating some buttons with normal hover focus mode and active mode. And lastly, general advice again, adhering to platform guidelines when that is natural, such as using, if you are creating an app or solution for Google Android system, then adhering to material design guidelines. And if you are creating solutions for iOS, then of course, using iOS interface guidelines as a foundation, and at least being aware of what these guidelines are, because if you do not, the solution that you are creating will feel like an odd man out and will not kind of comply or feel natural on that base system. That is it. Any questions? Yeah. Okay. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all luck on your exams. Are there any questions when it comes to exam? This is the last opportunity, I think. Peter is here and I am here. Everything is crystal clear. Good. Okay, thank you.